We are going to continue in our series called Acts of God, and we haven't done this for a couple of weeks. And I just love, and I've gotten a couple of people that I've shown this image to didn't get it at first, you know, and so, because you kind of look at it and it kind of takes a little bit to, you know, get the message there in that graphic. And so, but I just love the way it's, you know, no matter what age group you're in, how many people have heard this and remember doing it as a kid. You know, it's somebody say it. Somebody start us off. Here's the church. Here's the steeple. The doors. And there's all the people. And so it's fun to say that every time. You get a kick out of that. And so, we're looking at the story of the church, and the book of Acts in the New Testament tells that story, and in such an amazing way. And each week we've been looking at God's heart and just His miraculous work. I mean, truly, this couldn't have happened without the power of God behind it. Literally, acts of God. And any of you that might be in insurance or contract law or anything like that, that's a familiar phrase that comes up even when it's something completely out of our power. You know, we've got legal language to cover those events, and they come under that umbrella, acts of God. You know, it's like a tree falls on your house. You know, it's like, well, it's nobody's fault, really. It was a, you know, or lightning, you know, strikes your dwelling and causes a fire. Well, it was an act of God. There's just some things that are out of our power and out of our control. And the ability for the church to ignite and start and spread in such a way was so removed from human control. It's just so amazing to look back on the story and how God, in a way, and we're going to see this today, just surprised everybody at every turn with how, and they didn't see any of this coming, this work after work, act after act. And today we're going to look at an unlikely hero who finds himself in the middle of God doing something that was way beyond his imagination. And God saw something in him that no one else could see. And it makes me think of another little story. And so I know you guys are anxiously awaiting a football game here probably in a little bit. So I got to get your, you know, got to give you a little fix to do that. Anybody recognize this guy in the green and gold? And so we're in an unfamiliar number. And so a young Joe Montana playing at Notre Dame. So now, some of you might know the story, but Joe was, I mean, we, you know, those of us that grew up with him, you know, as a kid, is just our ultimate sports hero, was very panned and overlooked coming into the NFL draft as a college quarterback. The pro scouts virtually ignored Joe Montana. They questioned his arm strength and his overall durability. One of the chapters in a book recently written about him is called Glass Joe. You know, it's just that he was made out of glass. You know, he was just breakable. He wasn't going to hold up under the intense pressure and physicalities of NFL rushers and defense. As a result, he wasn't selected until the third round of the 79 NFL draft. I mean, and so he was one of those guys that was just sitting around waiting for a call, didn't know what was going to happen. And here's a guy that's got a national championship under his belt and was going to go unnoticed, undrafted. Who knows what was going to happen with him, except for one coach who was waiting in the wings, knew that he wanted him, saw something no one else could see. And I love this quote from Bill Walsh. The minute I saw Joe move, there was no question in my mind that he was the best I'd seen. Former head coach Bill Walsh said, referring to Montana's pre-draft workout, I knew with the offense I planned to run, Joe would be great. He was the perfect fit for what I had in mind. And so, you know, then the rest is history. Joe goes on to win four Super Bowls, and the poor 49ers have had to try to live up to that legacy ever since. But There's an unlikely hero that we meet in the book of Acts that we're gonna meet today that nobody wanted on their team, that's for sure. And so I want you to meet Saul of Tarsus, who was one of those guys that, according to him, had his act together. But according to those who were following Christ and being part of the early church, he was the last person anyone thought God would want or God could use. And even Paul, speaking autobiographically in these passages of letters that he eventually wrote, and you might know him as the Apostle Paul. He started off with a Hebrew name, Saul, and we'll talk about when and why he changed to a Greek name, Paul, and what happened there. But speaking of his former life, for you have heard of my previous way of life in Judaism, how intensely I persecuted the church of God and tried to destroy it. I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people and was extremely zealous for the traditions of my fathers. Speaking in the Philippian letter, he says, if someone else thinks they have reasons to put confidence in the flesh, I have more. Here's my spiritual pedigree. Circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. In regard to the law, a Pharisee. As for zeal, persecuting the church. As for righteousness based on the law, faultless. Here was an A+ student, somebody with some championships under his belt, part of the Pharisees. Who were the Pharisees? Take a little look at them. The Pharisees, the word literally means separate ones, those who separate themselves and are above and beyond the the gray masses, you know, the commoners, those who don't know as much. Or aren't as dedicated. The Pharisee party emerged largely out of a group of scribes and sages. Their name comes from the Hebrew and Aramaic perush, which means one who is separated. One of the factors that distinguished the Pharisees from other groups was their belief that all Jews had to observe the purity laws, which applied to the priests inside the temple. Regardless, all Jews should observe those laws outside the temple also. The contemporary historian Josephus notes the Pharisees were considered the most expert and accurate expositors of Jewish law. These guys were the best. And this young Saul was the best of the best. He was the up and coming. And he became known for being the strongest voice against the young Christian church because of his zeal for the traditions within Judaism that was rejecting this new sect that was exploding. And we first meet Saul in Acts chapter 7. And if you ever look at some of the old medieval art and even a lot of the modern art and the depictions of this famous chapter in Acts 7 where Stephen, the stoning of Stephen. And it's the bad stoning, by the way. And so, not that the other stoning is the not as bad stoning. So, kidding. Anyway, so, Stephen is claiming that he's seen God in this chapter. And that was too much for those observing the Jewish law, that somebody would claim to see God. And so they rushed to stone him. And as they covered their ears and yelling at the top of their voices, they all rushed at him, dragged him out of the city, and began to stone him. Meanwhile, the witnesses laid their coats at the feet of a young man named Saul. And you always see in all these paintings, somewhere you see somebody holding clothes in the background. You can see him over here, the clothes at his feet. And it's the first impression we see of who becomes the most famous, the most integral individual in the New Testament history, the Apostle Paul, starts off as this young man intently working against the church. And so let's dive into where we pick up in Acts chapter 9. And I want to show you two different accounts of Saul's little story here. One coming from Luke, the author of Acts, who ends up becoming one of Paul's best friends in life and strongest companions in Paul's missionary endeavors. But just to remind us how objective Luke is in his authorship and how he's more concerned about the facts than promoting any propaganda or anything like that. The phrases he uses toward Saul to reflect really what's going on, he doesn't hold back. Saul was breathing out murderous threats against the Lord's disciples. He went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues in Damascus so that he found any there who belonged to the way. The way, by the way, was the first nickname of the Christian church. Before it was called Christian or church or anything like that, the nickname was the way, the followers of the way. Remember that line when Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. The followers of Christ were called the followers of the way. This is the way, simply the way to God, the way to live life. The way to the truth. Any who belonged to the way, whether men or women, he might take them as prisoners to Jerusalem. He was ruthless. And nothing was going to get in his way. Nothing was going to stop him. He was going to follow through and do whatever it took to track down any follower of the way, no matter what town they were living in. Talk about an overachiever. He wasn't just going to police what was going on in the home base of Jerusalem, but he was getting special permission and the paperwork necessary to travel and take his persecution show on the road. As he neared Damascus on his journey, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice say to him, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And Saul, blinded by this light, looks up and says, Who are you, Lord? I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. Jesus replied, Now get up and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do. The men traveling with Saul stood there speechless. They heard the sound, but did not see anyone. Saul got up from the ground, but when he opened his eyes, he could see nothing. So they led him by the hand into Damascus. For 3 days he was blind and did not eat or drink anything. Give you a little idea of the geography. And so Jerusalem's way down here. He had to cross the Jordan a couple times on this long road trip up north to the Syrian nation. Where Damascus is the capital. And so it's a little bit outside of town is where this takes place, where he gets knocked off his horse and blinded by the presence of Christ coming to him in this incredible overpowering light, and yet speaks firmly but gently into Saul's life. So Paul gives his own account, Saul gives his own account later on when he's on trial with King Agrippa. And he gives a little more detail of what was said in that encounter, that miraculous encounter with Jesus. And he's telling the king while he's in chains, defending his accusations for being brought before the king. And he says, I too was convinced that I ought to do all that was possible to oppose the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And that is just what I did in Jerusalem. On the authority of the chief priests, I put many of the Lord's people in prison, and when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them. Many a time I went from one synagogue to another to have them punished, and I tried to force them to blaspheme. I was so obsessed with persecuting them that I even hunted them down in foreign cities. On one of these journeys, I was going to Damascus with the authority and commission of the chief priests. About noon, King Agrippa, I was on the road. I saw a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, blazing around me and my companions. We all fell to the ground, and I heard a voice saying to me in Aramaic, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And then one of the most amazing little lines in the Bible from the voice of Christ, it is hard for you to kick against the goats. What does that mean? I'm glad you asked. Let's look into that a little bit. What does it mean that it was a common expression in ancient times? It was rural language. It was farmhand language. To kick against the goats. A goat is simply, you know, when we talk about, oh, don't goad him on. You know, don't encourage him. You know, or they goaded me into doing this. You know, they kind of encourage me or egg me on. You know, we kind of say, egg you on. But a goad was a spiked stick used for driving cattle by the cattle hands. And to kick against the goads was a common expression in ancient times, a rural image which rose from the practice of farmers goading their oxen in the fields. Now here's the thing. They were for the benefit and guidance of the cattle to get them to water, to drink, to get them to the right grasses, the fields to feed on, to care for them. Goads were typically made from slender pieces of timber, blunt on one end and pointed on the other. Farmers used the pointed end to urge a stubborn ox into motion, to get him to the place where he needed to be. But the more the ox kicked, the more likely the goad would stab into the flesh of its leg, causing greater pain. And it was like when you fought against this instrument that was intended to bring you good, all it was going to do was hurt you. Fighting against it wasn't going to do you any good. It was just going to bring pain. But because of a animal's stubbornness and refusal to follow direction and guidance from its shepherd who was trying to lead them into a place of care, the result would be just making things harder on itself. And so when Jesus says those again, gentle but firm words, Saul, why do you kick against the goats? You're just making it harder on yourself. You're kind of digging yourself a hole here. You're going the wrong way. Let me guide you. Let's finish the story a little bit. He makes Damascus. In Damascus there was a disciple named Ananias. The Lord called to him in a vision, Ananias! Yes, Lord, he answered. Lord told him, go to the house of Judas on Straight Street. And evidently, there's a Straight Street still there in Damascus. And ask for a man from Tarsus named Saul. For he is praying. In a vision, he has seen a man named Ananias come and place his hands on him to restore his sight. Lord, Ananias answered, I've heard about this guy. I ain't going anywhere near Straight Street now. Okay, I'm just avoiding, that's the wrong part of town officially now. I've heard many reports about this man and all the harm he has done to your holy people in Jerusalem. And he has come here with authority from the chief priest to arrest all who call on your name. But the Lord said to Ananias, go, this man is my chosen instrument to proclaim my name to the Gentiles and their kings and to the people of Israel. This is my God. I mean, what unbelievable words. I mean, what an unlikely scenario. What in the world could God possibly see in this enemy? In this enemy of his, in this enemy of his people, the enemy, the number one enemy of his church, God is saying, don't waste a second. Get to this guy because he's mine. He's who I have chosen. He's who I want. He's my chosen instrument. He is who I am going to use to do amazing things that he would never imagine being a part of. Let that just kind of sink in a little bit. That God would track down his biggest enemy to do something to turn his life and perspective around in order to to use him to be on his team. God saw something in Saul that was so worth doing whatever it took to turn his life around and get him involved in going the right direction. And it just makes you wonder, man, is anybody off limits? Is anybody out of bounds? Is anybody not wanted? I mean, if you can use a life and a personality like that, I mean, it's like, that is not how I would go about it, that's for sure. It makes me ask many questions about God's plan, His abilities, His character, just the way I view myself now, the way I view all those around me. And I want to kind of just hone in on two questions that I think this story really brings out about when we think about how God builds up His church and brings people in. And the first question is a little more personal to each of us. And the second question has to do a little more with how we view those around us. But the first one really has to do with this whole idea of kicking against the goads. And no matter where we are in our spiritual journey and our relationship with God, it can seem that there's always something that we're still resisting. So I want to ask that question first. What am I kicking against in my relationship with God? What is it? And only you know. Only you know what is that thing that you just are holding on to. And even though you sense God is trying to move you in a different direction, even if it just hurts to stay here, I'm going to stay. Just because maybe I'm a little afraid of something new. Of him taking me to something that might be challenging me a little more, even though it's for my own good. Jesus tells this parable. That's one of those, again, Jesus, as kind and gentle as he is, because of his focused love on each one of us, can never hold back with telling us straight what true life is all about. And he tells this parable of the kernel of wheat. And very truly I tell you, this is from John chapter 12. Unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces much fruit. Many seeds, literally. Anyone who loves their life will lose it, while anyone who hates their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. And remember how we've talked about how Jesus uses that rabbinic hyperbolic language, you know, and when he says hate, he's drawing a strong contrast against loving this world versus he's not saying to take away anything from the gift of life that diminishes who we are and the importance and significance of our life. What this is saying is, unless you shed all the comforts and luxuries and ambitions that this world has to offer, until you do that and really let yourself fall into Him, you're just going to remain limited. You're not going to ever experience the full meaning and purpose of your life and what He has for you. That's why faith is such a big deal to God. But anyone who loves their life will lose it, while anyone who lets their life go in this world will keep it for eternal life. Whoever serves me must follow me, and where I am, my servant also will be. My Father will honor the one who serves me. And sometimes that whole letting my ambitions, my desires, my personal selfish hopes and dreams die is what it takes to really discover my true destiny, my true significance, my true purpose in this world. I've got to surrender some things. I've got to let them go. I've got to let God's direction take over in my life. And as painful as that might be, as painful of kicking against those goads might be, the best thing that can ever happen to me is to let God's direction take over my life and go with Him instead of just holding on to what I want, what I think is best for me. Maybe we could shut that door a little bit. That might help. It's still open. There's a second question that comes up from this story, which now we're forced to ask and view everyone around us in a completely different way. And the question is, what do you see in others? Because I know there's a big difference between what I can view in someone versus God's view. You know, and here's another little story of Jesus interacting with somebody that everyone had written off. No one would even advise Jesus to go anywhere near a guy like this. As Jesus went on, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. All right, red flag right there. Okay, you can't trust any of these guys. They've sold out their own people to make a buck. Okay, they're all corrupt. Just right there, tax collector. You can't trust these guys. They're no good. And what is Jesus doing? Why waste your time on a guy like this? Follow me, he told him. And Matthew got up and amazingly did follow him. While Jesus was later on having dinner at Matthew's house, for crying out loud, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, "What is going on here? Does your teacher just have no insight to human nature? Just no ability to really see people for who they really are? Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? Why would he do that?" The Pharisees asked. On hearing this, Jesus said, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick." And by the way, go and learn what this means. "I desire mercy, not sacrifice," pulling from the Old Testament prophets. "For I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." Jesus says, tongue firmly placed in cheek, looking at the Pharisees as if they're the righteous and they don't need a doctor. And they've got everything together. And so, Jesus sees something in someone that no one else would ever take the time to look for. But he could see a heart, talents, just if we could get him going in the right direction, what an amazing impact. Maybe all this man needs is a little forgiveness, a little unconditional love to show him how valued he is, to cause him to enter into a work that would now have a huge impact. Go on to write, you know, one of the most famous books of the Bible, the Gospel of Matthew. Who are those in your life? And, you know, I've seen this time and time again, and I remember the first time I saw it, I couldn't believe it was happening. It's like, that's practically how it happened to Saul in the Bible. And it was a guy I got to know because he was the dad of a kid on a mission trip that I was leading. And he decided he needed to be present there so his daughter wouldn't get in any trouble or end up joining some cult, you know, because I think that was his view of who we were as a church. And, you know, and as I got to know him later, you know, he admitted that, you know, most of the time he was very antagonistic, you know, in conversations, you know, towards God, you know, with God and all that stuff. It's just a crutch, you know, but getting to know him, you know, in this dusty little campground and him participating and getting involved and helping out, you know, a little more, and then some more conversations there on that trip, some follow-up coffees and lunches still, you know, and just some more discovery of God can love me. There's something to this. You
you know, never being judged, just being included and invited, and seeing the changes going on in his daughter's life, and coming to see that maybe there's some good things here. Dipping his toes, you know, and in the next few months, a lunch I'll never forget, when he asks, how do you become somebody like this? And you find yourself just saying a short little prayer with somebody who then, just like that kernel that needs to fall into the dirt to ever really become something, lets his life now go and fall into the love of Christ. And then all of a sudden what grows out of this is one of the most amazing leaders I've ever been around, inside or outside the church. Somebody who rallied service events, not just in a church, but throughout a city, throughout several cities. Somebody who many men now would look to for advice and counsel and understanding from God's Word and how to go about building ministries. And often we both joke about, you know, those you know, little tense conversations on those dusty roads and on that campground. But how it just convinced me, and then I started to see more of a pattern over the years of whether it was the husband that never came to church with the family, or whoever it was, slowly over time, because of that message of love and forgiveness and acceptance that continued to go out. And just tasting, you know, what it meant to give your life a little bit at a time, more and more, and to see what God could do with that, and see the amazing fruit that would come out of that. You just become convinced that there's nobody that's off limits. There's nobody. I mean, I want you to think of the last person in your life that you could ever see taking on a vital church ministry, or even coming into a fellowship like this, and realize that God has His eye on that person and has a plan in place to use that man or woman in an incredible way. And we just can never see anybody the way we used to see him ever again. God can see things that we just can't see. And God saw in the Apostle Paul somebody he wanted on his team. Somebody that could run his offense better than anybody else. Just like Bill saw Job, God saw in Saul that he had the gifts that I want this guy quarterback in my team. And here's a guy who put that energy and that devotion in the right direction, planted more churches, walked more miles to more cities, turned the Roman Empire literally upside down, almost single-handedly. Changed his name because he was born in Greek circles now, and you know, he was born of one parent Greek, one Hebrew, and so Saul was his Hebrew name in Hebrew circles, which was his primary focus up until this new calling. And he went by his Greek name, Paul, which also happens to mean little, which I'm sure he found handy, because he now went from everybody intimidated by the great Saul to how can you be afraid when you hear littles coming to town, right? And so I'm sure that took the edge off too. And I love how humble he becomes. And again, speaking about himself, "For I am the least of the apostles and do not even deserve to be called an apostle." But of course he does. "Because I persecuted the church of God. But by the grace of God I am what I am, and His grace to me was not without effect." His grace to me was not without effect.
And each of you can sit here today and say the same thing. No matter where you have been, no matter what you've been up to, God's grace in your life has not been without effect. No, I worked harder than all of them, yet not I, but the grace of God that was in me. And you've got to look again at God's overall strategy here. The 12 were hunkered down in Jerusalem. Everybody else was scattered. They wanted to stay in home base. It took finding a guy like Paul who wasn't afraid of branching out and going out into the world to move the gospel into the world of the Gentiles. So it was no accident God tapped his shoulder for that also. And he covers, again, more ground by far than any of his contemporaries. Whether then it is I or they, this is what we preach, and this is what you believe. And so, it's a story that just enlightens, again, how God's incredible hand in history worked to build up the church. And without His involvement, the church just goes away. It's because of the great acts of God that tells the story of the church, life by life, person by person. And there's so many stories still left that we're gonna continue to see each week. But the question I want to leave you with now is, can you see others through God's grace? Because you're going to leave this place tonight, and it could be on the way home, it could be any time during this week, whether in your workplace, whether in your neighborhood, even in your family, when you're going to look at somebody through human eyes that's going to judge their relevance and significance to doing anything good in this world. It's going to be very easy to write them off because of their current disposition, their antagonism towards God, their antagonism towards maybe your relationship, somebody that you just don't feel could be of any good to God's work in His kingdom or anything that could be part of a church. And we can't ever do that ever again, because we not only have seen it, glimpsed it in our own lives, we see it in Saul's life. You look around, most of those, many of those that are incredible positions of leadership can tell that story, and I know my friend can. And I've seen it many times, and I can no longer trust my eyes and my instincts. I've got to go on God's grace and mercy and what He's able to see in people. I would have never advised Jesus to take a second and to even pause at that tax collector's table. But now I know that if I don't pause at every opportunity and possibility in my day, in my life, my week, I'm going to miss something. I'm going to miss something that God has an opportunity for. And so let's not make those misses. Let's see things differently. Let's learn to look through God's eyes of grace and mercy. And so I want to invite, just ask Ryan to come back up and